WBR Fairfax Radio. You're on the Commons, and I'm Sue Bartholomew. And joining me on the Commons today, we have Tyler Birding. Tyler is an attorney out in California who's been studying condominiums. He's been working in condominiums for 30 years. And he's written extensively about the problems, and he's also taken out and dusted off his crystal ball, and we're going to be talking a little bit about that. Tyler, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Tyler, you said you were going to go back to the past and then leap forward and go into the future and tell us what you see as happening in associations. You want to do that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. In order to do any sort of, as you say, crystal balling of what we're likely to be experiencing with condominium associations in the future, you really have to go and rewind about 50 years into the past to understand where they came from and how we've come to the point where we are today with the community associations, as we call them in California, common interest developments, and what the situation is with them as we look at them today. And what we see today is an awful lot of condominium projects, community associations, which have reached a point where they are underfunded in terms of their long-term repair and maintenance budgets, to the point where they really can't undertake to maintain the buildings the way they should be. And as a result, we're seeing projects which are gradually deteriorating and where owners really are, their equity is subject to a greater and greater, let's call it unfunded liability for maintaining the buildings. In California, and I know in many other states, there is no mandatory assessments on condominium projects. And you may say, well, how can that be? Owners have to pay their assessments, or they can, the homeowners association could put a lien on the property and foreclose, et cetera, et cetera. And that's all true. But first of all, somebody has to set an assessment at an adequate level. And that's the responsibility of the board of directors. And there is nothing in the California law and nothing in the law of very many other states in the United States that requires a homeowners association board of directors to set an assessment at any particular level. And they are free to ignore the inflation of the cost of repair and other increases in expenses pretty much as they want to. And unfortunately, while we would like to hope that boards would be fiscally responsible, what we find is that they're much more vulnerable to politics than we would like. And as a consequence, really are reluctant to raise assessments anywhere close to the amount that they should raise them to keep up with inflation and to keep ahead of the long-term maintenance. So what we have today is an evolving situation that has put many, many older condominium projects fairly deeply in the hole in terms of funding their budget.
Tyler, can I jump in here for just a second? I've always been an advocate for making sure that you have the money when you're going to need it, for setting aside funding for not just condominiums, but also for homeowner associations, because you have pretty much the same concerns. Now, one of the arguments that I have run into from some of the people, and frankly, it's a very valid argument, and that is, I don't want all that money sitting there. It's too tempting. In Virginia, we have a case where a management company is being investigated for allegedly embezzling $2.2 million. I believe that that's a very low estimate, and it's just a drop in the bucket of what this one particular management company has taken that they're not supposed to take. you go in and you Google HOA and embezzlement or condo and embezzlement, you're going to run into a whole lot of articles of not just management companies, but board members as well. What's the answer there? I mean, if you go to law enforcement, they say, nah, you know, we can't get involved. It's a private matter. So it means the owner is faced with trying to figure out where the money's going.
I appreciate that issue, and we've seen some instances of it ourselves. But you can't steal what's not there. And frankly, the idea that we don't put the money aside because we're afraid somebody's going to steal it, I think would probably be putting, to use an old adage, put the cart before the horse. If you don't put the money aside, and I understand the interest of the security issues, there are ways to protect associations with bonds, surety bonds, things of that nature. I suppose you could say nobody can be protected against outright fraud, not well enough. But there are measures that can be taken to protect the interests of the association from just the kinds of things you're talking about. But to say we shouldn't save this money because we're afraid somebody's liable to take it or to embezzle it, I think would be a false notion that would put a lot of associations even farther behind in their savings plans than they actually are now. And I have to say that I think probably the instances of that are a small proportion or small percentage of the total number of associations that exist in this country. I would be very much concerned that would become a dominant principle in terms of how we handle our fiscal affairs in a condominium association.
See, I'd like to see us come up with some means of providing the oversight that's desperately needed. In the instance where you do have a situation where there is some embezzling going on, I think that some form of law enforcement ought to be able to step in. They've got a pilot program going on in Florida and in Miami-Dade where they're doing just that. So there is some assistance, and they've caught a number of treasurers who've had their fingers in the cookie, you know, in the cookie jar.
It seems to me that as an aside to our topic today, but I think that there is no question that anybody that has signatory authority over an association's bank account should probably have some kind of bonding in place.
So that would be something that should be looked into, basically.
Yes, I do think so.
I
would agree that's probably not the case, but you know, there are many, many fiduciaries that routinely have surety bonds which back them up or protect their principals from that exact same kind of thing. And it may be that our industry is still immature in that way, and those kind of practices, which are fairly common in the business world, just haven't gotten to the level where they're adopted with community associations, but they probably should be, and that is something we should look into more carefully.
Because that's just as much a threat as all of the other things that you're going to be talking about today. And I'm sorry, I kind of took you off track a little bit.
That's quite all right.
And it's my job to keep you on track, so.
Well, here's where all this goes. What really is the issue we see today is we see an awful lot of associations that just can't stay up with the cost of maintaining and repairing the projects. And what's happening is that slowly but surely they're running into a point where we could probably say they're obsolete in the sense that they're no longer financially functional. Or you could say they're functionally obsolete. They just can't do the job they're supposed to do, because if we can't maintain habitable housing, then they're not doing the job any longer. So the question then becomes what to do with them. We put aside reserve budgets for all the components of a building, or at least we should be, roofs and painting and asphalt and such things as that. But to do that, we have to estimate useful lives of those components. But no one ever estimates the useful life of an entire condominium complex. And you could say, well, you know, we don't have to worry about that because that's years in down the road. But in California, at least, the reserve budget has to, by statute, include any component that has a service life of 30 years or less. So, okay, when a project's new, that, you know, there are a lot of things that are going to last longer than 30 years. But the things that don't, like the roofs and the paint, that has to be in the budget. And that's all fine while the project's new. But as the project ages and becomes 20, 30, 40 years old, as we're now beginning to see some, clearly there are other components in that project which you cannot say is going to last another 30 years. Wood siding, for instance. And in California, and like a lot of western states and a lot of states in the south and even in the east.
In the east as well, yeah.
There are a lot of wooden-built buildings. They're wooden frames, they're wooden siding, they've got wooden stairways and wooden balcony. Every bit of them is constructed of wood, practically. And while in the first 30 years, if they're painted properly, you could probably say, hey, that wood's easily going to last 30 years. But when you're looking at a project that's already 30 or 40 years old, to say that all those wood pieces are going to last another 30 years is unrealistic. And yet we're not seeing an awful lot of those wood components included in budgets, reserve budgets, as they should be in these older projects. So they go further and further in the hole as they discover dry rot and other kinds of issues that all of a sudden we have to replace all the siding on a building. They're not funded to do it. So we've reached a point with some projects where obsolescence is becoming a feature, or at least something that's reasonably predictable. We had, in California, condominiums are basically hardly any that are even 50 years old now. The first Condominium Act in California was passed in 1963, and then we amended that with something called the Davis-Sterling Act in 1985. But the mass-produced condominiums for consumer use really started in the early 60s in California, and I think in most other places, in the way we know them to be now. And so that puts even the oldest ones at just under 50 years old, but it puts them in that 30 to 40 year bracket. There's a lot of them of that age. So you're looking at buildings that have lasted 30 or 40 years, and in many cases the maintenance on them has been deferred by their owners simply because they either didn't know that they needed to be aware of things that are out of sight, or they knew it and just simply didn't want to put the money away for it. And so,
We're talking to Tyler Burdick. He's an attorney in California. Tyler, let's quickly give them the website. You've got a blog where I found this.
Oh, it's www.condoissues.com.
And the article that we're talking about is Predicting the Future of Community Associations. You're talking about 30-year-old buildings. You know, I'm trying to envision sort of replacing stuff. If you've got a garden apartment or a garden condominium, how are you going to replace? You're right. Everything is made of wood. I call it cardboard and scotch tape, but you're being a little kinder. But at some point, I mean, how can you go in and just replace all of that wood, the construction? Because everything's biodegradable. It's all going to just crumble and rot away.
Well, and because of that, you've got two choices. You can either stay up with the cost of gradually replacing all of it, and I have any number of associations which are now facing that very real necessity of replacing whole chunks of that wood, balconies, staircases, siding, all wood trim around windows, all of that.
What about the structure, the actual structure of the building, the floor joists, the ceiling joists, the 2x4s that hold up the cardboard that's on the inside and the outside of the building?
Yes, what's happening, you see, in California, too, the reserve statute requires only that the inspections of these areas be in areas that are visible and accessible. That's the language from the statute, visible and accessible, which means basically you walk around and look at it. But unfortunately, because after 20 or 30 years of exposure to the weather, it isn't just the visible areas that are beginning to deteriorate. If you pull off pieces of this wood siding, as we've done in numerous buildings, you see that you see dry rot on framework inside. You see dry rot in floor joists where they adjoin balconies on the, where they come up against the exterior wall where water's gradually seeped in over the years. And you find that the framework itself is also affected by both water intrusion, pest infestations, any termites, all that sort of thing. Wood does not last forever, even when it's undercover. And areas of those buildings require a fair amount of rebuilding once that problem is discovered, and the money is usually not there.
Is it a viable alternative? I mean, can you rebuild a building with everybody living in it?
The question is it economically feasible to do it? There is another trend that I think is very interesting, and if, also on the blog is a little note about it. We have been projecting for a long time. Let's assume that the owners of, let's say, a 200-unit condominium project cannot stay ahead of the cost of repairing it. And I have at least one project that I know of where there's about a $90,000 per unit shortfall to do the work that needs to be done right now. And it was $40,000 about 5 years ago. They couldn't do it then. They can't do it now. It's just getting deeper and deeper. And basically the place is never going to get fixed. So what do you do with it? Because you've got 200 in a condominium, you've got 200 separate titles. It's like a 200-lot subdivision. You might be able to rehabilitate that project. In fact, some of these are very well located. They're close to urban areas. Maybe the urban areas are growing out to where they are now, and the land on which they sit could be used for a higher density project if you could assemble all those titles into a saleable parcel. But because in many states that requires 100% vote of the owners, and you never hardly get 100% of a condominium owners to vote for anything, they're basically paralyzed in that state until the legislature comes along and makes it easier to do that. Because what I was getting at is that as these various projects become obsolete, we have to find some other way to deal with them. And in other words, there has to be some kind of end strategy for them when they reach the end of their useful life. And right now, in the law in most states, there is no viable end strategy built into the law. And so they're sort of stuck in that state of being condominiums, notwithstanding their condition, forever, unless somebody finds some creative way to redevelop it.
Now, in a condominium, when you buy a condo, you don't buy real estate. You actually just only buy airspace.
That's true, but you buy it, and there is a recorded deed to that piece, that airspace, which means 200 separate titles in a 200-unit condominium project. And so there are all the, and anyone who would want to buy that whole project to redevelop it would have to be able to consolidate all those separate titles into one saleable parcel.
Right. Now, I'm thinking of the, I'm thinking of each of the 200 owners. You know, right now you have a roof over your head. You've been paying a mortgage for a long time. The idea is that at some point you're going to sell it and maybe make a profit because that's what we're told. And yet now, how do they walk away? Are they expected to just sort of like rent, just walk away from it all? Do they get anything for it? Small portion of the sale of the real estate. And what happens then? We take the land that 200 people sat on and we increase the density, and 30 years down the road we go through the same thing, right?
Well, not exactly, because I think one of the problems we have is that the size of a lot of these projects don't provide not only not the funding for their repair, they really don't provide enough money to oversee them, inspect them, manage them properly over time. not only does wood decay, and it requires a lot of maintenance, but it also requires good management skills to stay up with it, to keep it funded, to get good contractors in there to do what has to be done. We don't see this problem nearly as acutely with higher density, high-rise steel, glass, and concrete buildings, for example. Yes, you have problems with them, and yes, there are lawsuits over those, but it's far less frequent for a couple of reasons. One, a high-rise building is intrinsically way more valuable. You have a greater number of people living in it. It has the economic resources to be maintained with building engineers and people who understand how to do it. And so you have high-rise buildings, and you've had them in office buildings for 100 years, that are still sitting there doing just what they're supposed to do decades later, partly because of the way they're built. And what I see, one of the things we're
no cardboard and scotch tape, Tyler.
Nope, not cardboard and scotch tape. And what we're looking at is if we look at all some of these older complexes that are low-rise, stick-built, wood-framed, wood-sided buildings, that maybe their day is over in some places, and they should be rehabilitated or redeveloped into higher-density buildings on the same land. There is on my blog a story out of Houston where some very energetic, I would say, realtors were able to go around to 108 different owners and convince them that they ought to sell their parcel, their condominium interest, to a developer who was looking to build a much higher density structure on that property. Apparently, this complex was not too far from downtown Houston, and the effects of greater urbanization were moving out to where they were. And the property was well located. It was 5 acres. And right now, there was like 20 units per acre on that 5 acres. But the developers were going to come out and build a higher rise structure. I'm not talking about 50 stories. I'm talking about maybe 10 or 15 or 20 stories. And they were going to have probably 100 to 150 units an acre. They were going to make 400 or 500 units out of that same parcel. So what you're having, not only are you having, you have a structure that is better built, can be maintained more professionally, but you can house that many more people close to jobs, transit, and all the things that go along with being in an urban area.
We're talking to Tyler Birding. Tyler is an attorney out in California. He is also the author of a blog called, the one I have here is Predicting the Future of Community Associations, and it's predictingcondofuture.blogspot.com. And you had another one as well, Tyler, right?
Yes, all of those articles are consolidated on one, let's call it master blog, if you will, condoissues.com.
Condoissues.com. I recommend that you all check it out and read it. One thing I love about your blog, Tyler, is that you've always got such pretty graphics that go along with all of your stories. It's not just, just the writing. So very artistic. So we're turning the cardboard and scotch tape low-density condos into high-rises. Is that going to... What about the people who live in these condos? Are they walking away with any money at all?
Well, you got a couple of factors at play right now. And first of all, not only are all the issues we're talking about gradual deterioration over time, underfunding of the reserve budgets, but now you have an overlay on that of the economy and the housing downturn being what it is really the perfect storm for a lot of these projects. I have a third element that we haven't talked about yet, which has added a whole new dimension, and that's in the subject of condo conversions, where we take an apartment house that is already 20, 30, maybe 40 years old, and we convert it to condominiums. And it's been a very popular thing that has happened over the last 4 or 5 years. We usually see condo conversions happen when the housing market is very hot and you can sell anything that you put on the market very quickly. So developers look around for things that can be sold, and then apartment houses They usually are, they're already built. You don't have to build them. You don't have to get permits. You just go buy them and then go through somewhat of a rehab process and you have units to sell. The problem is that, at least the ones we see out here, these are old wooden apartment buildings. They're just like the wooden condominiums, but they're old apartment buildings. And frankly, they've probably often been not maintained even as well as their condo brothers. So we get, these things become conversions. They're usually sold often to moderate to low income buyers because that's the market they're shooting for. But invariably, there is an awful lot of deferred maintenance built up in these, which are not adequately rehabbed by the converters. They want to get in, get out fast, spend as little as they can on it, and move these and flip these units. And the budgets that go along with that have been found to be wholly inadequate to maintain these old buildings. So these poor folks who had thought they were getting a piece of the American dream finally find out that it's really a nightmare that they woke up to. And they are, all the problems we're talking about aging condos is now accelerated because we now have a building that's already that old, hasn't been maintained properly, and the budget, and they don't have any time to catch up. Even in a new construction where you find you haven't adequately reserved for something, you usually have 5, 10, 15 years maybe to catch up if you're on top of it. With a conversion, the time's up, and it's already ready to have a new roof on it or something like that, and the budget that was given to them is not going to do it. So we have that third element in on top of this, and in this down housing market, people are walking away from it.
That's not a very pretty picture that you're painting.
It isn't. And, of course, unfortunately, I guess from our business, we're seeing the ugly underbelly of an industry that promised very nice housing, you know, relatively low cost, the whole picture that condominiums provide, and they do provide that kind of housing for an awful lot of people. But at the fringes of it, we're seeing a lot of decay, and these whole conversion trend that we hopefully is over now for a while has just accelerated the problem. And we have an awful lot of people who bought into something only to find out that the budget doesn't address the issues that are going to have to be dealt with in terms of long-term repair.
I think in terms of the conversions, that tends to happen during a boom market, and we're definitely in a bust market right now. So I don't think that's happening at the moment, is it, the conversions?
No. In fact, a lot of converters are now stuck with dozens and dozens of unsold units, and that's posing even a greater problem because now you have people who bought into a condominium conversion thinking they were going to live with a lot of other co-owners,
oh,
only to find out that half of them are still renters.
Oh.
So that even makes it worse. And there are a number of projects that we've seen where that's the case, and and you've got the auction people coming in trying to auction them off, and nobody wants to buy them because they're at the bottom of the market.
And so the owners are trying to fund the common elements, right?
Well, there's no way they can fund what has to be done because they're so underfunded. The converters have simply, and often I'll have to say, they've misrepresented the condition. And with the converter, just to digress for a minute, the converter has three options, basically. He could make that project essentially as new by doing some extensive renovation. And so then the budget that he provides would be adequate to do to maintain the project after that. Or he could take the money he was going to spend on that renovation and he could put it into the association's budget so that it would have the money to do this work, but maybe more gradually. Or if he doesn't want to do one of the first two, he can raise the association's assessments to each homeowner when he sets them high enough so that they would generate enough cash over time to do the work that has to be done. We can do one of those three things. What he can't do is none of the above. Has to do one of those. And what we're finding, it's often none of the above. And because if he set the assessments high enough to do the maintenance and repair that needs to be done, nobody could buy the units. They couldn't qualify for the loans, even the loans that they were getting. they wouldn't be able to qualify because the monthly assessment was so high.
Yeah, I was going to raise that. I was going to bring that up because if the target is the low-income housing,
sure.
You know, the entry-level people, and then, you know, then you take a big chunk of what they would have qualified for and put it into assessments. That doesn't leave them a whole lot of money for the actual mortgage.
Well, and anybody who's any homeowner, I don't care what your income level, you're going to want to know. You're going to try. You want to know how affordable that home is before you buy it. And affordability is determined by what? The amount of your mortgage payment, whatever that was going to be, the amount of your property taxes, whatever those are going to be, and the amount of your homeowner's assessment. That counts into all of that, and your insurance, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Look at all four of those things, and you say, what's my monthly nut that I'm going to have to crack every month in order to own this place? That's how they understand whether it's affordable or not. And if that assessment is too high, it's not affordable. They either can't qualify for the loan, or they simply would know that they can't afford to make that kind of a payment, and so they would stay away and they wouldn't buy. So it is in a converter's interest to push that assessment as low as possible so he can qualify the maximum number of people. And that's unfortunately what we've seen.
And then you end up with people who, you know, think they got the American dream, and they really didn't, because they're, as you said, they're living the American nightmare.
Yeah, and what would happen is they simply weren't informed of the true cost of ownership, and everybody wants to buy, so they want to believe, and when they find out, they're not very happy at the other end. But sometimes there's not, you know, sometimes there's something they can do about it, sometimes there isn't.
You know, condos have been around a long time, and why is it that we're not any smarter about them now? I'm talking about buyers, potential buyers, housing consumers. You know, everybody walks in and goes, oh, gee, I didn't know what I was getting into.
Because, first of all, it's very difficult, even with the disclosures that are required by many states, it's very difficult to read that stuff and understand what it means as a typical homeowner. We spend an awful lot of time translating budgets for boards of directors because they don't understand why their budgets are inadequate. They don't have enough money. Why not? Well, for you know, there's all kinds of factors about why a reserve budget can miss the mark. And an average homeowner has no idea when he looks at that budget. He's looking at one thing. There's only one set of numbers that he wants to know. What does he have to pay each month? What the calculations that go into that are either not provided or not understandable. So they don't get that. They think that if they pay this much per month, everything else is taken care of, soup to nuts.
What's the answer?
Well, I think we need to be very, very careful about what kind of disclosures we allow developers and converters to give to buyers. And I can tell you that in California, the Department of Real Estate has been no friend to consumers. They are allowing things to happen that they should never allow to happen. Their disclosure documents are difficult to understand, difficult to read. They're dense. People just aren't reading them. And you say, well, didn't you read your contract? Think about the number of times you've watched a closing. There's about 20, 30 documents for signature. Here, sign this one. Here,
yeah.
Sign this one.
Yeah.
Here, sign this one. And they're all long, multi-page, thick legalese. I can tell you as a lawyer, I don't often read that stuff because I already know more or less what it says. But I can imagine, you know, a young home buyers are going in there and all these paper and all they're thinking about is this nice new house. They're not reading that stuff. They don't know any of that. And they're not benefited by what disclosures there are because they're dense. Not the people aren't dense, the disclosures are dense, and they're hard to read. We need to rewrite some consumer protection laws that have to do with disclosure so that it's not only the information is probably there. It's contained in those 10 or 15 pages of documents, but it's not understandable.
Tyler, 10 or 15 pages? try a phone book in some cases. These are ridiculous. And when you end up with these multiple layers of associations, you've got the master association, you've got the homeowners association, and under that you have the condo association, and all of that, you know, you're just handed this stuff, and all you want to do is go and measure for draperies.
Exactly right. And we, you know, we think we're doing these people a great favor by having all these disclosure laws, but the problem is that the language isn't understandable, and so the message isn't getting across. So people don't really know what they're into. But it's worse than that, because even if they understood that, in our case, the state of California does not require that there be an inspection of components that are not visible and accessible. So even if the budget is 100% in compliance with what the California Department of Real Estate requires, it may be wholly inadequate. What really has to happen is the various legislatures in the various states really need to take a better look, starting with this whole conversion thing and then going backwards to the older associations. How can we make sure that people understand what they're getting into when they buy into these? Because what's happening, too, is the seller of those units, I'm not talking about a new one, like the seller of a 20-year-old condo, he sells, and the buyer says, well, you know, what's the monthly assessment? Well, it's this. Well, how can I know? Well, here's what my board of directors sent me.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. But what really happens is, that project, if it's underfunded, that seller walks out the door leaving that behind.
Right.
His obligation accrued over the time he lived there is left in that condo. And the new buyer inherits it and has then stuck with it. And so we allow these various, we allow sellers to buy, there's another article on that blog, allowing equity to slip out the back door. And basically that's what happens. They get out with their equity, which should be impacted by this underfunding, but it's not.
You have some, you talk about that in the future portion of your blog. You want to go there, because we're rapidly running out of time, believe it or not. And you were afraid that we wouldn't have enough to talk about in an hour.
Let me talk about the next 50 years real quickly, because I think that's, as frankly, if we do it right, is a lot more optimistic than the last 50.
I don't know. You've got some scary stuff in here, Tyler. I'll be honest with you right up front. Go on.
Well, what I'm hoping we're going to see, and what I think we're going to see, number one, is we're going to see greater density in and around urban cores. And we're going to bring people back into the cities, back into the urban cores, to live in multifamily housing that is higher density, but also higher, more professionally built, less construction issues with it, because it is professionally built. And we're locating more people around the services they need, such as transit and their jobs and everything else. And, you know, a lot of what's doing this are these high energy costs are pushing people back out of the suburbs, back into the city. We have to stop subsidizing construction in the suburbs and start subsidizing construction in the cities, where we can house more people more efficiently.
Why do we want to bring everybody into the city? I mean, isn't the part of the American dream actually moving out to the suburbs, where you have a little elbow room?
Well, and I'll tell you what, if you go 40 miles, 50 miles out from San Francisco, out into the suburbs around here, you're going to see an awful lot of for sale signs, foreclosure signs, and people who can't afford to drive to work anymore. We've run out of that aspect of the American dream. We've extended it out beyond where it can logically sustain itself. So what we have to do is turn it around, and what I see happening, not because we'll make it happen, it'll just happen because it'll be economically the right thing to do. A lot of these old condominium projects, low density, spread out over 5 acres, 10 acres, will be redeveloped into higher density, higher rise buildings that are made out of materials that will last and stand the test of time. So that's one of the things we see happening. When you have buildings like that, you have some other things that are also possible. Number one, you can have a situation where it is possible that the homeowners association doesn't own the shell of the building. What you might have is a mixed-use situation where you have commercial, residential, and retail, all, and we see plenty of examples like that in cities now. And the shell of the building is owned by investors who maintain it on behalf of the investors, and basically the common areas are leased to the homeowners association and to the commercial association, but you have a professional owner who has a great deal of money invested maintaining the building, much like we maintain high-rise office buildings in urban areas right now. But we now expand that concept and include residences, residential uses, as well as we've also seen as these mixed-use concepts come up. So what happens then, you have homeowners who are not, they're more like, in a sense, they're more like apartment renters in high-rise buildings. They don't have to worry about the maintenance of the building. They aren't gonna, their equity is not going to get hit because they've underfunded the reserve budget. They will, you know, their association or they will pay a monthly fee, and that's basically their, you know, a rent, call it a lease of the common area that they get to use, which is where their condominium exists. So one of the things we may do is shift the style of ownership from this in common ownership that we have now, where everybody owns 1/100th or 1/200th of the common area, into something more like a commercial building that it can be better is better maintained, and you can fund that adequately and keep the funding where it should be. So that's another thing that I think we're going to see happening. I think we're going to see new methods of funding that can be used to cover some of these shortfalls or prevent some of these shortfalls. One thing that we should be looking at, instead of paying homeowner assessments out of monthly, like we're doing now, maybe we should be looking at deferring portions of that and take it out of equity at the time of sale. Not when people have the cash to pay their assessments, it does two things. One, it makes it a little easier to collect that money because at a time of sale there's money to be, there's money available. And secondly, it makes people, it's going to make people feel like they're not going to be able to leave the building and leave that shortfall behind. They're going to pay up when they leave, basically.
But what do you do in the case of an upside down? I mean, we've seen situations, and I've been around long enough, and nowhere near as long as you have in this business, but long enough to see where you've got upside down situations. In other words, the homeowner paid more for the house, the unit, whatever, than it's worth today because of the economy, and they have to move.
That's a problem that we're dealing with right now that, you know, we all hope is short term. And I understand, and that idea of deferring assessments, of course, wouldn't work where you have somebody who's upside down on his mortgage and is walking away from it.
However, I mean, they're upside down. They have to move. We've seen this time and time again. They're in the military. They've got a job. They have to move across the country or whatever. They cannot get the money out of their house, or maybe they just barely cover what they paid for it, and there's nothing left over. You're still going to leave. I mean, that's not going to be the whole answer for the association, because there's not going to be any money to take. The bank is going to take.
You obviously can't do a program like that anywhere, everywhere. You're going to have to be very careful if you allow that to happen, to make sure that you're in an area that has sufficient equity in the units to be able to do it. It has to be monitored. But the idea of allowing someone to, we see this in retirement communities a fair amount. People, there are a number of retirement communities around here where people don't pay monthly assessments, or they pay a small one, and basically the long-term maintenance and repair is covered by a transfer fee at the time of change of ownership. that the association charges, and it's done at a time when the unit is transferring. So we have a lot of precedent for that. But again, it's got to be done carefully. I agree with you. You can't just defer assessments and hope for the best.
Because, I mean, that doesn't sound like, yeah, you're putting all your eggs in one basket, and instead of saying we're going to do this on a monthly basis, where you've got some way of getting some money, you're saying, okay, well, we'll just take your equity that you've built up. And frankly, I mean, if you're going to be looking at moving up and you're going to give up your equity, that's going to make it a little bit harder in moving up in housing as we've traditionally known it. You go into an entry level place and it builds equity and you sell it and you look forward to taking the money that you made so that you can put it into something a little bit nicer and bigger. And now all of a sudden we're saying, well, you can't have it all. You're going to have to leave some of it behind.
Well, they're leaving some of it behind as it is. They're leaving it behind, but they're not leaving the equity behind. They're leaving the debt behind for the new owner, and the new owner doesn't know that until later. So some of that has to be equalized somehow. But I also, we're not talking about, if you were to do this, you wouldn't do it with your entire budget. You'd only do it without some portion of the reserve contributions for long-term maintenance for like a roof that's going to go on in 15 or 20 years. Your daily operating expenses and things like that would still have to be paid on a monthly basis.
So, but you said we're not going to charge assessments. We're just going to take it when we sell.
Only that portion of it that's reserved, that's the contribution to reserves, not the portion of it that funds operating.
So you're going to pay assessments, and then you're going to leave part of your...
That's the idea. The other things we're thinking about that's likely to happen or can happen is that any number of associations could join together, form something we call a maintenance trust. There could be a lot of names for it. Join 10, 15, 20 new projects together into a organization that allows them to pool their resources, hire the professional help they need, if it was a government entity, it'd be like a special district. In order to maintain these, because it's well known that homeowners associations took a lot of burden off of cities a long time ago, maintaining roadways and things like that, landscaping, cities no longer have to deal with. And basically what we're thinking is maybe some of this ought to be put back together into a larger entity that could then hire the level of professional help that it needs to maintain it properly and share the benefits of joint membership in a larger organization rather than a 300 unit or 200 unit condominium complex. Maybe you have 14 or you have 50 or 20 or 30 of these projects all joined together in a large maintenance organization that can do a better job than they could do on their own.
How much responsibility does the local government bear in some of the problems that we've been having? You know, the lack of ensuring that things are properly built, the lack of inspections. You know, you mentioned that they've shunted their responsibilities over onto the private sector, and now we're looking at trying to help the private sector. But the government's still getting a free ride on this, isn't it?
It isn't doing the job. As someone who's seen an awful lot of buildings taken apart in the last 30 years, I can tell you that the inspectors that are on the job aren't up to the task. Yes, we're supposed to be building buildings to code, but it's often not code violations that are causing the problems. Often it's a bad choice of materials, bad workmanship, the way the materials are put together, the weatherproofing isn't installed correctly. All of those kind of things have often as much to do with the labor pool that is available now to build these things, especially in boom times, than it does with the city. Where I lay a lot of the fault is with the agencies that are permitting these developments and approving their budgets and are not putting the components into those budgets or requiring that they be in there that would get them funded adequately. The construction is not what it should be. I think, at least in California for sure, where we had tax reform back in the late 70s, We've taken an awful lot of funding away from cities, and they've responded by pushing a lot of that back on communities. I mean, private communities.
You know, in California, it's always blamed on Proposition 13, but we see the same thing here, and we don't get a break on our taxes. We haven't sort of tied the hands of local governments. They keep taxing and raising taxes regardless.
I just think a lot of it is the fact that the public officials don't understand the problem. And they're only looking at the brand new buildings. We're talking now about buildings that are 30, 40 years old or having issues, and the city doesn't even hardly see any jurisdiction over that until it gets to the point where they have to step in and condemn something. I'm just going to say that happened in Sacramento a few years ago, and the city of Sacramento, California, had to step in and condemn two whole projects and take them over and redevelop them, put a lot of public money into making them right.
It's not just older buildings, Tyler. Here in Fairfax County, for instance, I mean, the county has required that, because they are redeveloping and it's going to increase density and, you know, all of that redeveloping and all of that wonderful stuff. But what they're requiring developers to use and test out in associations is something called a permeable asphalt. And one of the supervisors made the comment that this is going to cost associations a lot of money in the future, but we're not going to use it until it's been tested out in associations. So they're mandating the use of this stuff.
Well, and I have a feeling we're going to see more mandates in the form of restrictions to promote a whole green environment. You know, the materials. And what we've seen with a lot of materials that were touted as either less expensive or long-lasting is that they are put on without an adequate testing in the field. And, of course, by the time anybody discovers it, they've been put on acres of buildings. And then hardboard siding is a perfect example. It's made out of sawdust and glue. And it was touted to be the greatest labor, you know, money-saving material that the construction industry had ever seen. And most of it has had to be removed and replaced and rebuild whole buildings resided. Anyway, the cities don't test that stuff. They don't look at it. The municipalities approve those things on the say-so of a manufacturer or a developer, and nobody really tests it out or looks at any test results. And by the time we find out how bad it is, it's on lots of buildings.
Well, it's and look at the vinyl siding. I mean, everybody's got this vinyl siding craze, but that stuff is really dangerous. It melts.
Well, yeah, no, that and worse than that, a lot of vinyl siding was overlaid over hardboard siding instead of pulling the hard. Seriously, it was. That's how they fixed the hardboard. Fixed in quotes. The hardboard siding was they overlaid it with vinyl siding, which looked better for about 10 minutes, and then it begins to deteriorate too. So we have the problem of building materials that are not well tested and are still being used and promoted by manufacturers who've got the ear of the city.
Tyler, we're almost, we've got like 2 minutes left. I guess what you're saying is that the pyramids don't have to worry about being outlived by some of the stuff we're putting up in the States, huh?
No.
I
don't think so. That's the old stuff. But I do think that the good news is that as that stuff deteriorates, it is actually in areas often that can be redeveloped into better products, better housing products. We know how to build them. And I think that an increased density is actually a good thing for society if we can do it. And so I do see hope for the future that way.
If you look at New York City, from what I understand, in New York, people don't know their neighbors. They don't talk to each other because they all, you know, we have this need as people to guard our private space. One of the things that associations has been trying to do is promote a sense of community. I just somehow, do you think that you can have community in a highly built development?
High density developments? Oh, I think so. And I think it has a lot to do with the common spaces that are available for people. And in modern buildings, a lot more attention is being spent on common spaces, retail downstairs, restaurants, you know, gathering spots for people that are available. Where you're in the old brownstones and the old buildings in New York that you're talking about didn't have any of that. You had to go down to the corner or wherever you went. It had nothing to do with your building. You just knew people because maybe you all hung out at the same bar. But I think we're building in a lot of that to these mixed use, you know, these mixed use projects, these, with all of these common areas built into them. And I think that's going to promote a lot more sense of community than we had in some of the older cities.
Tyler, thank you so much for sharing your crystal ball with us today. I really appreciate it. I hope that you come back sometime and talk to us a little bit more.
It would be my pleasure.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. Thanks again for joining us. And
well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.